In a recent book by Stuart Banner, the author recounts the abandonment of natural law reasoning in the American legal system of the 20th century. What once was seen as an indispensable part of a lawyer's toolkit has been replaced with fashionable theories of positive law or legal realism rooted in man-made systems and predilections. No longer are we to call forth that great, eternal, and unchangeable law of Cicero. Now we invoke the words of Oliver Wendell Holmes and render our profession as tour guides to fellow citizens looking for help. My name is Anton Sorkin, and this is The Crossing Gavel. We start off the year with a bang, talking today with the one and only Hadley Arkus about his brand new book, Mere Natural Law. Hadley is known best for his career and scholarship at Amherst College, where he taught political theory and jurisprudence, as well as his current role as founder, director, and lecturer at the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding in Washington, D.C. Hadley, welcome to The Cross and Gavel. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks much for inviting me in, Anton.
I want to begin by asking you to tell me a little bit about what have you been doing this semester, and really maybe telling the audience a little bit about this great James Wilson Institute that you've been really a big part of kind of building out and being a witness to and a lecturer for.
Well, this was, it goes back about 10, 11 years. And I had an offer to form, get a project going to restore to lawyers and judges and ordinary citizens the understanding of the natural law. We named the project after James Wilson, one of the premier minds among the American founders. And he was drawn to it because he drew upon the great Scot philosopher Thomas Reed, whose writings on common sense philosophy, on those precepts of common sense, that the ordinary man not only has to know, cannot only grasp, but has to grasp just in getting on with the business of life. And so in the very first case printed in the U.S. reports, Chisholm versus Georgia, James Wilson, in the opening lines, invoked Thomas Reed, said that we're at the beginning of our law. We have no distinct precedents to cite under this new constitution. So we must go back to the general principles of jurisprudence. But before that, we must go back to the principles of mind. He invokes Thomas Reed, writing about the principles of common sense, standing against that moral skepticism that prevailed in Europe at the time he wrote. That moral skepticism showing itself under false pretensions of liberality. So the argument here is the first step in the American Constitution in understanding jurisprudence and the American law was to detach ourselves from moral relativism in all of its forms. So we're going to, As I've argued here, this is not, we're trying to bring natural law away from the sense that people have it as some kind of theory hovering in the sun and in the sky. No, it's woven in with the axioms, the truths that are ground our practical judgments. So I think in Reed's perspective, you might say, before the average man would be bantering with David Hume about the meaning of causation, he knew his own active powers to cause his own acts to happen. And what we want, I recall the book having a conversation, recalling a former president of Amherst College saying that Hadley has a theory of natural law. I said, when you say that, you suggest you're standing back in wholesome detachment, watching theories whiz past, and somehow you're able to form judgments about the strands of those theories that are plausible or implausible, true or false, And I said, take me back to the ground on which you understand those things, about the things you reliably know, and you would be back to the ground that some of us take to be the ground of the natural law. Now, I've been doing these podcasts on the book, and sometimes it's been like, you know, Brian Lamb on C-SPAN saying, would you remind our readers who again was Lincoln? Something like that. And people would say, would you tell our listeners, what again is the natural law? And I would dip into Aquinas and Kant and say, it's the law that underlies all of the laws. It's the law that tells us why we'd be justified in having positive laws, those laws that are enacted. Why we'd be justified in having those enacted laws in the first place. And so we see the signs on the highway saying 65 mph, 35 mph. But behind those signs, the mind will come. Behind those signs is a deeper natural law that tells us why we'd be justified in restraining the freedom of people to drive at speeds that put innocent life at hazard. And so the task as ever is to make a transition from that underlying principle of the natural law to apply it to the circumstances and terrain before us. 65 on that open highway, 35 on that winding road. That's how it, natural law always has to make its way into positive law, applying it to the circumstances before us. But going back further, it also tells us just who has the authority to make that positive law in the first place. Now, years ago, I was at a Americans Defending Freedom program with that professor from Notre Dame, Amy Comey Barrett. One of the students asked her, well, why do you have such, you know, you're a clerk of Justice Scalia, you share his passion for the positive law. And a student asked, why does the positive law evoke such reverence from you? What makes the positive law in America stand on a higher plane than the positive law, say, in Stalin's Russia? Well, she was a little taken aback by that. And I said that the key really lies in the string of three questions that John Locke had posed. We said, what is the source of the law? The legislature, which makes the law. Well, then what is the source of the legislature? A constitution that tells us whether we have a legislature, how many chambers, what powers. So then Locke asks, what is the source of the constitution? It must be, he said, some source wholly antecedent to the powers of law, some principle. In our case, it ran this way. No man is by nature the ruler of other men, the way that God is by nature the ruler of men, and men are by nature the ruler of horses and cows, and therefore the only legitimate government over human beings must spring from the consent of the governed. Now, my dear late friend Antonin Scalia said, yeah, but it's not part of our law. It's never been enacted. And the response was, of course it couldn't be enacted. That was the point or the truth that had to be in place before we knew who had the authority to enact anything. You see, Lincoln, after all, in the first inaugural address, had an exquisite explanation of why the only operational form of rule by the majority, of all, the only operational form of the consent of the governed, was the rule of majority under constitutional and moral restraints, a majority that understand it then didn't have the freedom to just rule anything in its standings as a ruling majority. But he assumed the truth, the anchoring truth, was in place. We understood what the truth was, it tells us, that no man by nature could be the ruler of other men in the way that men must be by ruler, by nature the ruler of horses and cows. And as Jefferson said, anyone who denies that must assume that the mass of mankind were born with saddles on their back, and to prove it's few, spurred and saddled, ready to ride them. Yeah, So in other words, the notion of, so the question was, where in the world would it be wrong to rule human beings the way human beings must rule dogs and horses? The answer was, anywhere in the world where that nature remained the same, and we could still understand the distinction between God and man, and men and animals. Hence the notion of natural rights, rights that are grounded in an enduring nature that separates the human from the divine and the subhuman. Now, James Wilson said, a marvelous passage, we didn't bring forth this government for the sake of inventing new rights, but to secure and enlarge those rights we already had by nature. And, you hear people say, those rights I have through the First Amendment. You mean in the absence of that amendment, you don't think you'd have the presumptive right to speak, to publish? Wilson noted Blackstone saying that when we enter civil society, we give up those unrestricted rights we had in the state of nature, including the liberty to do mischief. To which Wilson asked, when did you ever have a rightful liberty to do mischief? Or as Lincoln would later say, actually following Aquinas, when did you ever have a right to do a wrong? And so the point was, those laws that are restraining you now from murdering and raping and stealing are not restraining you from anything you had a natural right to do. So when the question was raised at the beginning, what rights do we give up on entering under this new constitution? The answer tendered by the Federalists was none. Hamilton said in Federalist 84, here the people surrender nothing. And so the question was raised, well, wait a minute. Then what is the rationale for this codicil you call a Bill of Rights stipulating those rights we had not surrendered in government, unless you are now implying that we had indeed surrendered the bulk of our natural rights on entering under this regime? People, even judges and lawyers are often unaware that there was this serious argument about the Bill of Rights at the beginning, and that the reservations didn't come from men who were reserved about rights, but concerned that we were misinstructing the American people about the very ground of their rights. Those thieves were, as Sedgwick said at the time, wait a minute, you think in a free society you wouldn't have a presumptive right to speak, to publish, in fact, a presumptive right to every dimension of your freedom? Why did you specify my right to walk down the street, my right to wear a hat? Oh. But yet, the notion was fostered that those rights that were mentioned in the Bill of Rights were somehow more fundamental than those rights that were never set down, like the right of an unborn child not to be killed without justification, or the right of people not to suffer eugenic experimentation and to be sterilized out of some guess that they were retarded and would perpetuate their kind. So it gave rise to a long running, serious confusion and argument about the matter. But all this goes back to the fact, the awareness of certain rights that were simply grounded in nature, from the things that will ever separate human things from the subhuman and the divine. And part of the argument here, as I told you, is that we're dealing with things that are accessible to ordinary people. And so, for example, if I may, you want me to continue in this vein, Anton? I don't know.
Yeah, and if you can maybe introduce a little bit of context for how people actually come to recognize this duty to obey certain moral obligations that, in your estimate, comes through rationality, common sense, kind of a common understanding, a common awareness of those things.
Yeah, I'd say, as one test case, what ordinary people understand. You tell the ordinary person that Jones, accused of a serious crime, was undergoing surgery the time the burglary was committed. Or that Jones hadn't been born yet. You know? the ordinary man would tell you, ask you, the ordinary man wouldn't have any problem with it. He'd say, why are you prosecuting him? The ordinary man would understand at once what Kant and Thomas Reed and others took as actually the very first principle of all moral and legal judgment. And that is, it makes absolutely no sense to cast judgments of blame or praise on people for acts they were powerless to affect. As Thomas Reed said, to approve or disapprove of the conduct of anyone who had no power to do anything else, it's so patently wrong. He said that principle, that axiom, would be as true as any axiom in Euclid. Now, from that simple axiom, many things will follow. We don't hold people responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. We understand that we do hold them punishable for wrongdoing. After John Stuart Mill said, we stop using the language of like and dislike and start using the language of right and wrong, as we think people may be rightly punished or rightly restrained from what they're doing. Well, okay, we don't hold people responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. We hold them responsible for what they themselves did. But if we respect the difference between innocence and guilt, then we're committed to making that distinction, to testing evidence in the most demanding way, according to the best rational canons of testing evidence, rather than having people run over hot coals or suffer a pummeling of the chest or head. We're saying that we are committed to respecting that matter of guilt or innocence by using the most demanding test of evidence before we punish them. Now we trace the implications, Anton. One of the next steps is to say, well, anyone accused of a crime should have access to the witnesses and evidence against him for the sake of rebutting them. And rebutting them, achieve a verdict that is substantively accurate in discriminating between innocence and guilt and not punishing even an innocent person. Well, in other words, if we just draw out the logic, we do come to the implication of a right to confront witnesses against us. But the point is, that flows from the very logic. These deep principles of morality will be there even if there were no Sixth Amendment. In fact, we recognize that the founders never thought to put that provision in the original text. Just as James Wilson and Oliver Ellsworth, two of the critical founders, were against putting anything in the Constitution about ex post facto law, holding people punishable for something that had not been illegal at the time it was done. They thought that was so obvious that you would embarrass us by putting in the Constitution. Thomas Cooley, the great 19th century jurist and teacher, said the due process clause. The due process clause is the great vehicle for the natural law. It's people just threw out implications, like the right to confront witnesses against ourselves. Implications that were there and perhaps have hit or fallen. And of course, we realized later that's like the notion, all cases should be treated by like rules. Really, people take that as a principle of our law. Really, why is that a principle of our law? You see a statute that says, that forbids racial discrimination in private businesses open to transactions with the public. Now, do we assume that statute is to apply to everyone who comes under that, anyone who owns a business and engages in racial discrimination? Do we assume it applies equally to everyone? Well, that's a moral logic, isn't it? That's a moral logic. Why is that there? If you ask people, we've seen Supreme Courts in the States who say, it must be a deep principle that all like cases should be treated under like rules. And then therefore they say, the logic of the Equal Protection Clause must be part of our Constitution, right? And then they go on from there to say that the Equal Protection Clause entails the wrongness of barring a surgery performed solely on women, abortion. You know, they make their way through wrongful reasoning. But the point is, they recognize that there is some deep principle there. And we say, okay, we look at this. We explain it only in this way. We say, like cases be treated in a like way. It's only because you assume that there's a moral logic, that if we say it is wrong for somebody to discriminate based on, if it is wrong to hold someone in slavery, for whom is it wrong? For anyone, for everyone. There's a moral logic there. And so many judges, and even lawyers, the moral logic is so woven into what we're doing that the lawyers no longer notice it. They don't know that they've been dealing with all this. So that old line of mine I used to say, for a lawyer or judge to get through the day without falling back on the axioms of natural law is like asking the question, can I order the coffee without using syntax? Of course it's there. You're just not noticing it's there. And one of the things we try to do, we say we're trying to do in this project, is restore to a new generation the furnishings of mind, the furnishings of mind of these remarkable men who made this Constitution. And I was criticized by someone saying, well, the judges never thought they could appeal to principles outside the written text, except that they did it conspicuously, importantly. They did it all the time. And God, the most elegant example, if you're open for one, was Alexander of John Marshall in that case called Fletcher versus Peck from 1810 or 1812, where there's a scandal in Georgia and the legislature repealed this grant of lands. And the repeal of the grant of lands was taken as impairing the obligation of a contract. The grant had been made, many innocent buyers had bought it. Is it impairing the obligation? Well, that's Article 1, Section 10, impairing the obligation of contract. So the court and John Marshall could have settled the whole case by saying Article 1, Section 10. But instead of doing that, they did something far more elegant. Marshall showed how the contracts clause could be drawn deductively with the force of a syllogism from that deeper underlying principle on ex post facto laws that everyone knows just must be implicit in the logic of law. And when he did that, he came up with this remarkable conclusion. He said, Georgia is a great state, but even if Georgia were a separate sovereign state outside the American Union, outside the Constitution, outside Article 1, Section 10, this law would still be wrong because its wrongness is rooted in a proposition that does not depend at all for its validity on being mentioned anywhere in the text. And what Marshall was really telling us is that, don't you understand that those things we consider to be basic law are more truly basic law because they would be there even if they were not out in the text. Just as John Stuart, John Quincy Adams would later say, that right to petition the government is simply implicit in the idea of a free society. It would be there even if it hadn't been mentioned in the First Amendment. You'd be there even if there were no First Amendment. You'd be there even if there were no Constitution. And John Marshall, the old Dartmouth College case, said that to impose upon people a contract they did not wish could be as bad as impairing the obligation of a contract they'd willingly made. And Joseph Story later in his commentaries would say that principle would be true even if there were no Constitution. So what we're trying to do, Anton, is take what was there before the Constitution. The founders were drawing on axioms of moral truths that were in place. That's what they drew upon in framing the Constitution. They're trying to create a structure. The structure is important. I mean, I've got to know such things as, may a state make its territory available as a military naval base for conflict country? I've got to know that. Who succeeds if a president dies? Whom the army obeys if the president dies in office? We're going to have elections every 2 or 4 years in this country, even in times of war. These are important things. These are structural things important to know. But the beginning was of the whole thing was on those propositions that established in the first place what it meant to have a rule of law, a rule of moral judgment applied to concrete cases. And the trick was to show that those things that were, they understood that those things that were there before the Constitution were deep axioms, true things that were true of necessity, and they would be there even if there were no Constitution. And so if we understand that, we get a different understanding of what we mean. Why do we have this? Why would we have reference for the Constitution? You may change different parts. You may not want elections every 4 years or 2 years, and so you may change the different parts. But we understand the underlying set of principles about the terms in which these people shall be governed. Let's say one other practical. You ask what the ordinary man thinks. If I open one more of these, Anton.
Yes, sir.
Imagine a 7-year-old who's set upon by roughnecks in school. They steal his lunch money. Now, I've asked people, which of these two accounts would you think would be the most natural? One, did the youngster feel set upon, that he's treated unjustly, he'd been wronged? Or two, he thinks, no, they must have been right, they succeeded. I see no one who takes the second path. But any kid understands naturally, is Rousseau's point in The Social Contract, that the mere success of some people in seizing and holding power over others cannot itself establish the justification for that power. To say that is to say that might makes right. He said, well, what quality can there be in a right that changes hands as soon as might changes hands? The students grasp that. But Justice Holmes, posing the question of, on what ground does the majority rule the minority in a democracy? His answer was, it has the power to overpower the minority, which is to say, the rule of the strong, might makes right. My pitch is that the 7-year-old naturally understands, naturally grasps what the highly read Justice Holmes talked themselves out, because he had a theory by which he could talk himself out of the thing that any normal person and any child could grasp.
Let me ask you a little bit about this. That example you have regarding the theft itself, we just saw a rather stark hearing with the presidents of UPenn, MIT, Harvard. I guess American was there too, but she didn't get as much highlight as the other three. And obviously they were presented this scenario of calls for intifada, what a lot of people understand to be calls for the eradication of the Jewish state and by extension, the eradication of the Jewish people. And a lot of them try to contextualize their answers, because although all of us sensed the wrongness of what was being protested, their response was not intuitive the way you and I would understand in that example of the first boy's response. And then they thought maybe might does make right, kind of appealing to Douglas, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And that seems to be a pervasive problem within the university, is that they're missing the underpinnings of our moral obligations by imposing a structure of positivism or maybe even realism. Can you maybe talk to me about how this, what you call a passion for relativism, has kind of creeped into our university and has slowly choked out our ability to not only discern, but also teach and discuss the underpinnings of our moral obligations?
Well, sure. Now, that example of those three presidents, you know, what those three presidents were doing was giving what you'd be the ordinary liberal line. You get it from the ACLU and probably get it from many people. In fact, they'd say, yeah, people should be free to get out there and even make the case. Well, what's it like, right? Justice Alito and Gorsuch said, people are free to say even offensive things. Even offensive. This we had during the argument over the Nazis in Skokie back in the late 70s, where I was taken, invited by the ACLU to state the opposite side. And Dave Hamlin said at the time, we must be free to hear the Nazis because we must be free to choose the Nazis. And he said, the First Amendment protects all speech, whether popular or despised. He gave us a translation. By despised, he means unpopular. In other words, they rule out the notion that there's something in that could be in principle offensive or despicable. So you take a look at the president. So, and the conventional liberal line is, yeah, you're free to argue anything offensive, even genocide, as long as it doesn't cross into action. So I say, really? Could we be free to hold a demonstration in favor of lynching on the campus, lynching black people? As long as we don't actually lynch black people? Is there nothing in the very constitutive principles of a university that can yield a judgment against that to say, do you think that the killing of the innocent is something that doesn't collide with the deepest principles of this university or decent society? They've long given this up. I mean, I have a dear friend who said a while ago, yeah, I was with you with the Nazis in Skokie, but it was a Nazis parading in a community containing survivors of the Holocaust. But wouldn't it be a different thing if that same flaring of the Nazis was in outside the Pentagon or downtown Washington or outside the Pentagon? He said, really? Really? You say, you can still can't see there's something about that that's just not fit public discourse. It just goes beyond the edge of what is fit in public discourse. I mean, we used to have an understanding of that. We used to understand the old Chaplinsky cases. They were so geared to ordinary language that people could inflict harms through the use of speech as well. You could defame people. You could incite hatred. You could inflame a mob. You could make threatening phone calls in the middle of the night, send extortionate letters and so on. The hurt may not be material, but it's still a hurt. It could be an assault that the law recognizes. And we knew that certain expressions and words we don't want to see, the N word, the F word, are words that are used as assault in terms of denigration. And when that's done, we can say it's not fit for public discourse. It's not, and we could ban it without banning anything necessary for our public discourse. So that one notable case you remember, Mr. Rosenfeld versus New Jersey. Rosenfeld is getting up at a PTA meeting, and he has one adjective, mother effing. Every other third word is mother effing. And the point was, you can't insist that Roosevelt stop using that language. And you not really deny his freedom to give the most searing critique of the school board. Just as Justice Berger once said, a couple having intercourse on the steps of City Hall, acting out a metaphor of what they think the administration is doing to the city, that can be banned. And you could, and when it's banned, you know it, we're not interfering with the freedom of that couple to make the most scorching critique of the administration of the day. This was Justice Murphy's opinion in the classic Chaplinsky case, that you can ban this kind of speech because it was not necessary to the exposition of ideas or substance materials. Seth Waxman, I mentioned that book, Seth Waxman, defending against use of bad language. Yes, the Fox is trying to ban certain language from the airwaves. He's trying to rise to the defense of the F word, F the SH four-letter word. And never in the course of his opinion did he use those words he was seeking to defend. Because he recognized there's something about that language itself not fit to be spoken in the civil hearing of the Supreme Court. And yet not using those words did not impair his substantive argument. He won his case. Now what you see, this has all disappeared, but more than that has disappeared from the life of the university. Why wouldn't you have the most natural response to this thing with Hamas is to ask the question, you people are demonstrating. The most natural question is, what is the wrong done to the Palestinian people that you think justifies kidnapping grandmothers and beheading children? Tell us what the wrong is that you think justifies that. What has been done to the Palestinians? Barack Obama, it's an insufferable, what occupation? Occupation suggests people are being ruled without their consent. Palestinians are being ruled without their consent, mainly in the Gaza Strip and in the Palestinian Authority. They're not seeking the overturning of that those regimes. No, their argument is that the land should be theirs, Jews should be out, and Jews should be just cleared out by any way possible. But the curious thing is that the most natural reaction, question, how do you justify this stance of you? Why has it disappeared from the universities? Why wouldn't those be the first, you know, years ago, during the war in Vietnam, there were teach-ins where students were inveighing against the war in Vietnam. And in the 60s, there were still faculty like Zbigniew Brzezinski at Harvard and others who were ready to step into the conversation and defend the war in Vietnam. So you'd have an argument. Well, where is it now? Where are the faculty in these colleges and universities who are willing to confront these people and say, oh, well, what is your moral argument? You're saying you have a moral argument. Well, what is it? Can you explain what justifies this kind of savagery? Why is that question not being put? Well, Anthony, you see, that has just disappeared from our universities. You're saying the most natural mode of principled reasoning about the things that are right or wrong has evaporated, no longer there, or people no longer have the courage to stand up for them, the faculty, and insist that it's a faculty. It's not the rabble, it's not the street, bringing together a mob in the street. It's a university where we have discourse, we have argument. People present their case and defend their cases. Why not here? You know, its disappearance is a good, I think what I've heard from people say more and more over the last weeks is that the eruption of these disturbances at the colleges and in the streets show us, it just expose the corruption, the moral emptiness of what was used to be known as our best colleges and universities. And it's, I don't know what will restore it except perhaps a kind of religious reawakening, something to jar people to the recognition this just can't be right. I just saw the figure the other night that we've had in Washington this year, 978 carjackings, 77% at gunpoint. Well, how did this come about? It's come about with a movement to be more liberal by deciding not to prosecute youth for stealing things under $750. Not because more black kids are being punished, we should just stop punishing, recede from the enforcement of laws. And what you've done is create a virtual license for theft and stirring people onto new modes of ingenuity and figuring out how to use smartphones in coordinating their groups and staging the attacks, as though these people are utterly incapable of figuring out their incentives. And as though this is not having the most, quite apart from the injuries that's produced, the corrosive effects on the character of the young people who've thrown themselves into this, as the law has withheld its moral judgments and virtually invited people to degrade themselves. So it's running now deeper than the universities. When you, after all, when you have a situation of transgenderism with a massive amount of money put in to create a new malady, to invent. 40 years ago, who heard of dysphoria, gender dysphoria? Who heard of this? You had to invent a new malady. And you bring forth the money to create a new journals about it, to credential new people to write about it, credential new members of the medical profession to treat it, to have remedies, to invent new surgeries to disfigure children. Without, as though somehow the difference between males and females was some kind of project of invention or imagination, as though it were not, once again, grounded in objective truth. I saw one article from Chris Rufo pointing out one of the exponents of this field saying, yes, the purpose here is to liberate us from nature itself, from the objective truths of nature, to show that we are the authors of our own existence, right? Liberate us from nature itself. And of course, from the creator who brought forth that nature.
It's a powerful project, obviously, going back to Francis Bacon, this idea that mankind will put itself in the place of the architecture of nature, the authority over nature. And obviously, you know, you are familiar with Abolition of Man and the way that Lewis makes the argument throughout his text, very much akin to your own book, this idea that we need to not only discover the underlying moral obligations, but also move towards obeying them and living our life consistent with those principles. One of my favorite lines in that book is when he talks about not enjoying the society of children, but then recognizing that is a defect in himself. And one that he's got to overcome. That's personally an issue that I have because I'm not married and I certainly don't enjoy the society of children, but I'm slowly understanding that is not a defect in children, but a defect in myself and the way that I was wired to be in community and have kind of been deregulated away from that instinct by the culture of individuality, atomization, all those things that, you know, has caused so much havoc in the 20th century in the wake of the application of liberalism. Do you suspect that the moral obligations that you and I would agree should be the governing principles of society are not identified? Or do you believe that it's one of those things where we've kind of just replaced them with other obligations that have now become the standard bearer for how people behave?
I can recur to the notion that we're dealing with some of the most natural things. That, after all, people are brought into this world by parents. They learn to be dependent on parents. They cultivate a sense of obligation to parents. But we realize that it took somebody to talk us out of this. It took a theory, the most natural. I think when I was a youngster, I think people want to be married and have children. It seemed the most natural thing to do. But now we've had to bring forth theories to tell us that we don't really need a marriage as the framework for having children. The children truly embody the characteristics of both parents. They embody the marriage of parents. And what the marriage reveals is that a commitment, and law has always been part of the commitment. You know, there's sex without law, but there's not been marriage without law. Because what the notion of a commitment in law means is that the partners have foregone their freedom to quit this association as it meets their convenience. And even the child may absorb the sense of that, that his parents are there. They've foregone their freedom to quit him as it meets them, their convenience. Well, it's taken a lot of theory to break this down, to say, no, it's not so bad to have children out of wedlock. No, you don't really need marriage before you have children. That enveloping structure of nurturance is really does not matter. I mean, people had to be talked out of this. You know, there was that old joke of Red Skelton's reflection of a culture that fled. Red Skelton had a line that said, they had a military wedding. I think they had a military wedding. Let's put it this way. There were guns there. There were guns there. That is, even in the days of Lil Abner and Dogpatch USA, people that didn't assume if there was a pregnancy, they would just throw it away. You're not free to throw it away. You'd assume that if there's a pregnancy, there has to be some nurturing structure of commitment around it. It took a good dose of theory and new understandings to talk us out of the things that people are naturally inclined to do and naturally inclined to recognize.
Let me ask you one more question. You talk about talking us out of these moral obligations. My last question is really, how do we talk ourselves back into those obligations? You have this great axiom by Aquinas that the good is to be done, evil is to be avoided. I know you've thought about this for a long time. What advice would you give, I guess, law students and maybe young attorneys to start talking ourselves back into the conversation on how to recognize moral obligations, the ones that are underpinning our structure of society on a global, universal level, the way the Cicero kind of understood the law itself to be something that's ubiquitous, not something that's relativized or localized? How do we start to try to reverse this trend that you've been discussing?
Well, first, just believe it or not, just talking yourself, reminding ourselves that, and this is what we get from our courses, where students say, you know, there really are necessary truths here. The necessary truths. And you know, I used to cite that line from Hamilton, the Federalist 31 on taxation. He said, in dispositions of every kind, there are certain primary truths or first principles upon which all subsequent renderings must depend. He said, these contain an internal evidence, which antecedent to all reflection or combination command the ascent of the mind. Like the maxims of geometry, two lines count in the closest space, two things equal to a third or equal to one another. Of like nature, those maxims of ethics and politics, they cannot be an effect without a cause, that the means must be proportioned to the end. There ought to be no limitation placed on a power destined to affect a purpose which is itself incapable of limitation. He told us, John Marshall, Hamilton, Addison knew this, there's certain things that had to be grasped per se note as true in themselves. Like the law of contradiction, two contradictory things both cannot be true. The ordinary man may not have heard of the law of contradiction, but he knows when people are telling him conflicting stories. But what I found, remember one line years ago, 10 years ago, one of my students, we looked at Aristotle and say, look, what can we recognize once we understand the difference between human beings and animals? No human being is the ruler of others in the way that humans must be the rulers of dogs and horses. Where would that be true? Anywhere, everywhere in the world. So as Lincoln would say, Jefferson articulated an abstract truth applicable to all men and all times. And Plato would show, once you bring that out, you've got something that's actually irrelevant to the culture. It will be true in all cultures, in all times. I remember one student many years ago saying, you know, I thought all of my opinions are simply drawn from those of my friends. Sometimes you have access to truths that are there, that are knowable, that you can grasp in yourself. But let's take one example, for example. I'd say in most cases, just to remind people, as we do it in this way, there really are truths that the founders recognize as true necessity, and that ordinary people can recognize for them. But here's an interesting one kind of example we put to ourselves. You know, the old biblical injunction, honor thy father and thy mother. Well, we could point out that can't be referring simply to the biological father and mother, because it would enjoin us to honor the man who sired us in the course of a rape. What it must be referring to is the mother and father who bore the moral functions of mothering and fathering. That is to say, the people who are there to nurture and protect as well as to give birth. Well, my sense, Anton, is when you explain that, people say, well, of course, must have been what it meant. And what we get is we go through these things on these axioms of natural law, we get the sense of people think, yes, I think I've known that all my life. I think I've always known that. Remember, it's like Plato's Meno. when he gives the this boy, he just feeds him the questions, and he starts working out geometry. And what's the pitch? That it's locked in you already. It's locked in you already. And simply a matter of remembering. Or we might say, Anton, reminding them what the questions were elicited. Once people hear the questions, what if Jones was in intensive care following surgery, the time was permitted, he's being prosecuted, the average man went, what? Why are you doing that? He knows. He grasps it already. It's a matter of giving the people the occasion to draw upon what they truly do know, and know as a matter of common sense.
The Cross and Gavel has been a production of Christian Legal Society, aimed to build up Christian law students and attorneys to intelligently engage their world and better love their neighbors. Follow us on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify to get all the latest episodes. Until next time, grace be with you all.